This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear about the protest over clothing guidelines at a Unit 5 junior high and get the school district's reaction. Parents and residents are critical of the principal's voicemail message they say is aimed only at female students.
Shorts should cover students' entire bottoms. There should be no bare shoulders, no visible bra straps, or no midriff showing.
GLT's Judy Valente talks with a spokesperson for the parents and a Unit 5 official. During an edition of GLT's Datebook, find out how students involved in their community are being recognized. You'll hear about the YICU Youth Service Awards. And GLT's Judy Valente helps you better understand the important work of a cancer center chaplain. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's May 1st, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. How much skin is too much skin to show at school? That's the question swirling around a stricter dress code articulated last week by Kingsley Junior High School Principal Shelley Erickson. Erickson said some female students were pushing the limits of the Unit 5 dress code, so she left a voicemail message for students and their parents warning that bare shoulders, visible bra straps, and tops that show midriff or, quote, excessive cleavage would not be tolerated.
Hello, Kingsley families. This is Mrs. Erickson, principal at KJ. The good news is that warm weather is finally approaching Illinois. The bad news is that I'm starting to see students come to school inappropriately dressed. Our handbook says that clothing must adequately cover the body. Here are some guidelines for you to follow. Shorts should cover students' entire bottoms. There should be no bare shoulders, no visible bra straps, or no midriff showing. And shirts that show excessive cleavage are also not appropriate for school. I know that it's difficult to find popular clothing that meets these criteria, but really, KJ tends to be cold, not hot. If the office deems that clothing is not acceptable for school, your student will be given a choice to wear PE clothes or to call home. We really appreciate your support with this.
Erickson's announcement unleashed a storm on social media as some mothers objected to female students being singled out for their clothing choices. The Facebook group ReSisterhood, formed in January following the Trump inauguration to monitor women's issues, complained of a double standard. Sarah Lindenbaum of ReSisterhood says the unspoken message is that male students might be too distracted by some of the girls' outfits. In a blog post, ReSisterhood said there is a parallel here with victim blaming of survivors of sexual assault. In a few minutes, you'll hear Unit 5's perspective, but first, GLT's Judy Valente talks with ReSisterhood's Sarah Lindenbaum, who has been in touch with several Kingsley mothers.
These parents aren't suggesting that the dress code be done away with altogether. Clothing that exposes, you know, buttocks, nipples, you know, anything that leads to nudity, that's completely not appropriate. You know, there are also rules against clothes with drugs and alcohol or obscene language. In this dress code, students can't wear coats in the classroom, and the reasons for these rules are pretty evident, and they don't seem to be targeted at one gender or the other. So what we're talking about here is a rule that seems to unfairly target female students when you break it down. Short shorts and belly shirts and spaghetti strap tank tops aren't in fashion for boys right now. It's pretty clear that Erickson is referring only to female students. And the coded language here, and I apologize if this is blunt, seems to be that girls' clothing has the potential to sexually arouse young men, which then distracts them from learning.
Isn't part of the problem that these are the fashions that are being sold to young girls today?
I want to stress that these female students are by and large wearing clothing which can be found in the junior section of any department store. Women and girls wear sleeveless tops during hot weather, whether you're talking about camisoles or blouses. I mean, that's just where fashion has been for over a decade now.
Are you suggesting that if there is going to be a dress code for girls, that there be a dress code for boys, and that boys shouldn't be allowed to take their shirts off at, say, a hot day?
Absolutely. And actually, if you don't mind, I did pull up Erickson's direct quote here. It's, there should be no bare shoulders, no visible bra straps, or no midriff showing, and shirts that show excessive cleavage are also not appropriate for school. And that seems clear that she's not talking about boys wearing sleeveless tops or boys going shirtless. She's specifically speaking to female students. The principal does have the power to make the final decision about appropriate dress code, but in this case, the parents are asking her to reconsider. You know, the rules are outdated and they punish female students for what male students might hypothetically do or say. So if the dress code is revised, which is what the parents want, language that targets girls should be taken out. If bare shoulders aren't okay, put a rule in there that says all students must wear shirts with sleeves, emphasis on the all, or something like shorts and pants must cover students' entire bottoms, because then you're not singling out just the female students.
What response have parents gotten so far who have mentioned this to the school administration?
The school administration has been absolutely silent on this subject. The parents have sent multiple emails. They've called Shelly Erickson's office. You know, there has been no response. And, you know, I understand that it might be, you know, a little bit, intimidating to get a barrage of questions from multiple parents, but administrators are paid to address questions like this and, you know, to respond to concerns of parents.
Isn't there a broader issue here that maybe styles for young girls have gone a bit too far? Maybe the stuff that is on the racks is a little too extreme.
Absolutely. One can make the argument that young girls' clothing is a little sexier than it used to be, but that's sort of an issue that's got to be addressed more broadly with advertisers, with manufacturers.
Some would say there's a good reason for girls not to expose their midriff at school or to wear something that is too low cut.
The objection that the parents are raising right here is that when you tell girls that they can't wear certain clothing into the classroom, and it's important to note that we're assuming that this is clothing that would be perfectly acceptable to wear out in public, we're sending the message that the female students are responsible for the thoughts and behavior of male students in addition to their own. That's a lot of responsibility. And it ties in directly with the phenomenon of victim blaming. We've all heard the argument before that a survivor of rape somehow provoked the attack because of what she was wearing. You know, the perpetrator just couldn't help himself because her skirt was too short or she was showing too much cleavage. And the parents feel that female students are made to take responsibility for how male students might react to their bodies. You know, it's a lot of pressure on young girls when they're also trying to earn good grades and, you know, do well in extracurriculars and figure out their identities, you know.
We're talking about 5th to 8th grade girls. This is a very sensitive time for them, isn't it? They're struggling with body image all the time.
It's important to note that it, in a lot of cases, it probably has never occurred to many of these female students that they're being seen as sex objects. Again, we're talking about 5th to 8th graders. You know, it's got a potential to embarrass them at a point when they're trying to cope with puberty and become comfortable with their own bodies. You know, another point that we talked about in the blog post was that clothing does not fit every girl the same. You know, this isn't the 1940s when, you know, you still took your clothing to a tailor or your mother tailored it for you at home. You know, what looks a certain way on a thin girl might not look the same on a larger girl. So it's harder for large-breasted girls to find tops that fit. And a lot of times, no matter what they do, the tops expose cleavage. And it's not intended to be sexual at all. It's just merely the way their bodies are built.
There's also another question here about teaching boys to be respectful of girls no matter what they're wearing.
That is absolutely important. And nobody disagrees that adolescent boys are hormonal. You know, both sexes are when they're going through puberty. But part of transitioning to adulthood is learning to control your language and your behavior. You know, it's insulting to the intelligence of male students to suggest that they won't be able to focus in class if they look at a female student's bare shoulders. I mean, it's ridiculous. Probably the most important part of this issue is what actually happens when you send a girl to the office because you've decided she shouldn't be wearing a tank top in school is that you're disrupting her learning. I mean, no preteen girl wants to spend the rest of the day wearing dirty gym clothes. You know, it's humiliating. She doesn't want to play phone tag with a parent trying to arrange for a new set of clothes to be brought to school. That's taking time away from the classroom. You know, are standards for male students different than standards for female students? Because right now we've got a double standard.
Sarah Lindenbaum with Resisterhood talking with GLT's Judy Valente. Unit 5's Director of Secondary Education, Laura O'Donnell, has a different perspective. She says the school district's written dress code is gender neutral and that Kingsley's principal was merely trying to rein in students who push the limits of appropriate clothing. O'Donnell tells GLT's Judy Valente there is a larger issue involved with retailers marketing ever more revealing clothing to ever younger female buyers.
The handbook language is very gender neutral. It does not reference girls or boys. It simply references students. And so if a boy were walking down the hallway in a tank top or something showing his stomach, he would be addressed in the same manner that a female would be addressed if she were walking down the hallway in a tank top or something that bared her midriff.
But the language that the principal used in this particular announcement mentions bra straps, mentions midriff. I mean, it really does seem pointed at the girls.
The reality is that the way that 11, 12, and 13-year-olds dress, you don't typically see boys wearing those types of things. So she was trying to be specific so that when questions came her way or if there was a question about an outfit, that the students would have a very clear idea as to what an infraction would look like. And so our reality as educators is that we typically don't see males wearing those types of things. If we did, they would be addressed in the same manner that the girl and the female infractions are.
So it seems as though you're in support of what this principal has done.
I am in support of our handbook that is board approved, gives building principals the final say and discretion as to what the specific guidelines are for their building.
Some of the parents, particularly mothers, are saying this is a broader issue. This is about saying girls have to watch the way they dress because they could cause boys to have some sort of a sexual reaction. They've said it's similar to victim blaming that occurs in sexual assault cases.
I am not going to comment on those that have chosen to make this a bigger issue. It's simply about our policies, our practices, and our ability as a school to define what appropriate clothing is.
Do you anticipate that the principal might be more specific, might send out another message and be more specific about this includes boys too?
I think that that would probably be a good idea, and just referencing parents back to the handbook so that they can see the gender neutral language that is included in the handbook, I think that would probably be a good idea and might allay some of the fears or the angst that we have heard around this.
There's also a broader issue in that if teachers and administrators have a problem with this type of clothing for young girls, shouldn't it also be brought up to the retailers? I mean, this is what's in the stores.
You are right. It's challenging. I have nieces. I've been shopping with them with my sister, and there are constant conversations around that is not something you're going to wear to school. That's not appropriate for school. So I live this in my own personal life, and I know that it's a challenge. It absolutely is. But these are 11, 12, and 13-year-olds, and it is okay to have some parameters within our schools as to what is appropriate. It might be a little challenging at times to find clothing that's appropriate, but we are not asking for them to be fully covered from neck to wrist. So there are things out there that are available. I think parents just have to be mindful of that when they're shopping.
Some schools do have a dress code, and it is girls wear this kind of skirt and this color top, and the boys wear these khaki slacks and this color shirt. I wore a uniform my entire high school career. I went to a girls' academy. Should we bring back uniforms?
Actually, when I was a high school dean or assistant principal in this district, that was my running joke. If we had school uniforms, my job would be, you know, greatly diminished in terms of these types of conversations that I had to have with students. I think what we need to do is achieve a balance. We want kids to be able to express themselves through their clothing. And as a public school, I don't think that there's any interest from the administration in moving towards a school uniform policy. but we just need to kind of shore up some of the stuff that kids are wearing to school. For the most part, our kids do a great job. There are just a few that try to, you know, push the envelope, maybe purposefully or not, but this was just meant to be a reminder as to what is appropriate when kids are coming into school.
Has anybody thought through, though, that these young girls may be sent to the principal's office, they're going to be taken out of their class, they're going to be taken out of the learning environment? Is it really worth it?
Again, we have the right as a school to define what appropriate dress is. And just as with any other infraction, we have the right to follow through on what consequences might be appropriate. And oftentimes, especially for a first offense, this is simply a conversation between the administrator and the student, just reminding them of what the dress code looks like. We never try to take kids out of their instructional classes for an extended period of time. And even when we do call students down, we try to find those non-instructional times throughout their day that we can get to them.
But the principal specifically said that you're going to have to change into your gym clothes or call your parent to bring you another set of clothes. I mean, that could be very embarrassing for a young girl, especially these girls who are just becoming aware of their bodies. They're fifth through eighth graders. They're having enough body image problems as it is. And everybody in the school's going to know that they were singled out because they're wearing the gym clothes, or their parent has to come and give them another set of clothes.
And I think that's why Mrs. Erickson was trying to be proactive in hopes that that won't happen, and letting kids know what's appropriate so that we don't have to get to that point.
Thank you, Mrs. O'Donnell.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
Unit 5's Laura O'Donnell says the school system has received emails from parents supporting the Kingsley Junior High dress code. As a parent of both male and female students, one parent wrote, "I thank you for sending that out. I was not offended by it, nor did I think it was aggressive or inappropriate," the parent wrote. On the opposite spectrum was this comment on the Resisterhood Facebook page, "I think the problem is men and their entitlements, not our clothes," one woman wrote. "Don't blame females for male problems." You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
For GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Governor Bruce Rauner has raised eyebrows across the state, giving himself a high performance rating when asked by reporters. That's grist for the Illinois Politics Roundtable. IPR's Sean Crawford moderates the panel, joined by Brian Mackey of IPR, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, and starting the discussion, Chicago Public TV reporter Amanda Vinicky.
The question was basically, you know, you've been around for 2 years in office, more than that now, Governor. How do you think you're doing? And he did say, yes, he'd give himself an A, the caveat being things that we can control. And the takeaway from that, I think, is very much how the governor views his time in office. He says that they have had successes when it comes to criminal justice and issuing executive orders when it comes to ethics. And it continues this pattern of the finger pointing, the blame game, where he feels like his agenda has been stunted and blocked by House Speaker Michael Madigan. It's true. What the follow-up question, this was an interview that I had with him earlier this week, the follow-up when the governor gave himself that sort of pat on the back was, well, okay, you said things that you can control, but you're the governor of the entire state. This was one of the issues. You knew going in, it is not like owning your own company. You are not just the CEO in a private business that can tell people what to do. You campaigned as somebody with quality negotiating skills. Isn't it your responsibility, if you want things passed, to work with House Speaker Michael Madigan or whatever, get him to submit? And the governor really didn't, I guess, take the bait, quote unquote, there. He continued to just say that, again, he believes that he has done well with what is in his control, and back to that finger pointing.
And this exact same dynamic came up in a Senate hearing this week. The governor's chief of staff and his top budget administrator were appearing before one of the Senate appropriations committees, and they were asking, and they made these same points, the things that the governor can control, and we can't force you, the legislators, to pass our agenda. And I think that that certainly rubbed a lot of the Democrats the wrong way, because it's not the governor's job to force people to do what he wants to do. It's his job to either persuade them or get their constituents to persuade them and negotiate with them and try and reach a compromise. And so, you know, what the governor will say is that he has been blocked at every turn. I think what Democrats will say is you came into office not recognizing that you had, when you started, Democratic supermajorities. You put up an agenda that is way farther to the right than the Illinois General Assembly, as it is composed, is willing to go. And they say he hasn't really budged off of a lot of those things. Now, he's narrowed his list of demands, you know, to get specific budgets. His turnaround agenda started with 44 points. At one point, it was down to 5 items. But those items are still largely as he proposed them initially, in terms of a permanent property tax freeze, things like that. And Democrats say, you know, we're not willing to go there. And they have not yet, at least, been able to bridge those differences.
You continue to have, it seems, a Democratic supermajority not recognizing that there's a Republican governor and a Republican governor not truly recognizing or acting in recognition of Democratic super majorities, or at least, pardon me, majorities. That continues. I do think, getting back to the governor giving himself a grade, that has picked up some traction because, of course, Illinois is now, what, Brian's been counting, 667 days as we tape this without any budget. And it strikes people as particularly tone deaf. I'm not sure how well that carries, even if the governor does feel as if he is stunted and doing his very best with what he can, being up against the Madigan quote unquote wall. As you mentioned, Sean, they did meet for apparently about 40 minutes. We don't know what all went on there because it was a private meeting, and particularly private. Typically, you have at least chiefs of staff or maybe a top budget aide in on these meetings. Apparently, this was just a one-on-one with Governor Bruce Rauner and House Speaker Michael Madigan. Was it just a PR stunt of sorts? Because Madigan has truly been, I think, in the shadows for the better part of this session. We saw last year, the speaker was making frequent appearances before the press, coming down to the Blue Room and answering questions, being very public. Now the House Democrats are more public than they used to be. They've got a Facebook page and a Twitter handle, so they're active on social media. But we've seen very little of Speaker Madigan on the House floor, very little in terms of any sort of interviews. He hasn't done those. So was this just him trying to kind of protect himself and saying, hey, look, I'm out there, I tried? Or is it a sign, as you termed it, Sean, that the Cold War is thawing, that the speaker said he asked for this meeting because he wanted to relay to the governor the importance of passing a budget and focusing on a budget? Their reaction that you got from both the speaker and the governor was pretty true to form, what they always say.
And we'll get back to the meeting here in just a second. But I know Charlie, being a professor, he has his own grading scale. So I guess I'll ask him what he thought of that remark by the governor.
Well, I would look at it in the sense that as a professor, I've been blessed to have very, very many talented students in my classes, outstanding journalists. As a matter of fact, 3 of them are on this program. But I never ask people to give themselves their own grade. And if you look at what is the one thing that a governor and a legislature have to do, and which every other governor and legislature since 1818 have accomplished, be it Republicans or Democrats in control, it's pass a budget. So on this most important issue of all, I would give the governor a big fat F.
Well, you have to give, don't you have to give the legislature a pretty low mark as the Democrat controlled
legislature? But the difference is, and the choice of language is telling. What he can control, or we can't force you. Well, there have been Republican governors and Democratic legislative majorities for a long, long time. As a matter of fact, the governor likes to castigate Michael Madigan. Most of the time, like two-thirds of the time that Mike Madigan has been speaker, there have been Republican governors. And governors Jim Thompson, Jim Edgar, George Ryan were able to sit down and negotiate an agreement with Madigan, and in the case of Thompson, the Democratic-controlled Senate. And so it's the outlier in this is Governor Rauner, who comes in with this attitude, well, what I can control, I can't force you. No, it's not about forcing. It's about sitting down and recognizing that there are some things that may be on your wish list that the other side isn't going to give you. And so you find a middle ground.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Brian.
I would say, Sean, to your point, I think the administration made that point this week in that Senate hearing I referred to earlier that, yeah, back in the summer of 2015, the House and Senate sent the governor a budget. It was $4 billion out of a balance. They admitted it. They didn't make the cuts or tax increases that were necessary to balance it. And the governor ended up vetoing almost the entire thing. Some people say he should have used his veto authority to reduce it and try and manage spending. The governor has since said that he doesn't think that's possible to do that, but he did approve the education budget. What happened the next year? The House passed a $7 billion out-of-balance budget. The Senate said, we're not going to take it up. So ultimately, the legislature didn't even bother trying to pass a budget last year. And I think that they certainly deserve a huge heaping of the blame for where we are now. Because as Amanda pointed out, they have supermajorities, or they did have supermajorities. And yes, you can argue that they were on paper only because there are certain Democrats who are never going to vote for tax increases. But you know, ultimately, they never even bothered to put those roll calls on the board because they're afraid of the political consequences of being out there alone, you know, trying to do what many people would argue is the responsible thing, which is, as the speaker has said, you know, a mix of cuts and new revenue to balance the budget.
Well, let's go back to that meeting then that took place this week, and I believe it lasted less than an hour. So for the first time in 2017, the top two people involved in this budget fight get together, and they don't even stay behind closed doors for an entire hour. Any idea? I mean, we've just talked about the fact Democrats could come through and put their own budget out there and see where it goes and send it to the governor. Maybe he likes it, maybe he doesn't. At least it could start something moving. But there's no indication that meeting at least launched any type of any changes of where we're at right now and where we've been for the last many months.
You're right. There was no indication that anything is different. It is, I think, telling that it took this long. We are nearly in May. That's when session is supposed to adjourn. You've got weeks left before this is supposed to be settled. The legislators, the top legislators and the governor haven't met at all since early December. And yet we're in this most unprecedented, horrific financial situation. It demonstrates to me that the fact they met is less significant than the fact that they went so long without meeting at all. It really shows where we're at. It remains to be seen whether there was anything productive about this. Perhaps it's good that it was just the two of them without any aides, that reporters didn't know about it, weren't watching until after it was all over with. Again, is this just a sort of PR stunt so that it can appear like they're going through the motions? We don't know. As yet, neither side has said that there's another meeting at all on the calendar.
Of course,
I would suspect that part of the motivation was that the speaker is hearing from his members, as are Republican leaders in the General Assembly and the governor himself, about the damage that is being caused to the most vulnerable people in our society because of this standoff, the human services that are being shredded.
Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, joined by reporters Amanda Vinicky and Brian Mackey, and IPR moderator Sean Crawford. The governor and Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan met alone last week, though what took place depends on who gives the account. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Coming up, hear how the job of a cancer center chaplain differs from those who serve hospitals. GLT's Judy Valente has the interviews ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A local philanthropic organization wants to spotlight some big-hearted young people in McLean County. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
Young people in our community are receiving positive attention for the work they do helping others with the YICU Service Award. And you can see to it that a worthy young person you know earns an award for giving back. The philanthropic organization behind the YICU Award is For a Better Tomorrow. Cheryl Hussein is on the board of directors.
And we do global philanthropy locally here as well with our youth programs, and then we also do it globally in India and our new project in Haiti.
All right, so you're doing the YICU Service Award. Give me some background on that.
It's a project we started last year. Last year was the inaugural event, and we did it to recognize youth that give back to the community. We felt that there was a gap in our community of kids that may not get recognized for the community service they do, because we know that students get recognized for band, for academics, for athletics, but we felt that there was kind of a gap that needed to be recognized for those students who do give back to their community.
Well, could you give me some examples of what the kids are doing in our community?
Sure. Some of them are serving as mentors in academics. Some of them are serving in their church. They're helping out with non-for-profit organizations, whether it might be Habitat for Humanity or Humane Society. So we're finding out there's many things that the kids are doing in this community. We just want to recognize the students who are giving back just to encourage them to continue and, you know, continue as they grow up, continue serving the community and just knowing that we appreciate their efforts.
What is it that the young people get when if they win this award? Is it just a trophy? Is there a check? I mean, what goes on with it?
Yeah, good question, because last year we were able to just give out awards, but this year we are growing the event, and FBT is actually going to give a $250 check to a nonprofit organization that the student serves, and there will be 10 students chosen that day.
What are the age categories?
The age category is from 12 to 22, so we're looking at the age from junior high to college student.
So what's your selection criteria for this award?
We are looking for students who have a strong desire to become better leaders in all aspects of life. They would need to show the ability to lead and inspire others and possess a passion for serving others.
So what's the event timeline, Cheryl? I mean, right now we're talking about this, and what we're trying to do right now is get young people interested in nominating their friends or even nominating themselves
Absolutely.
For this award. And what's
yes.
the deadline we're looking for?
We're looking at June 15 for the application deadline. And like you said, they can go online, they can nominate themselves, they can nominate a friend, and they can do the application online as well.
Where do you see these young folks heading one day? If you've got someone who's 8, 9, 10 years old, up to college age, who's getting involved in the community and doing volunteer work, what does this build within that young person, and where could it take them one day?
Well, I think we've seen this already happen, that so many times these students give back and, like I said, maybe not have been recognized. And we're hoping that if we recognize them, it'll empower them a little bit more and give them courage to do the next thing, whether that is being a servant leader in college, helping out with non-for-profits, and just exposing them to more non-for-profit opportunities, I would say.
Do you think with the YICU Service Award and getting more publicity regarding that you will inspire young people who maybe aren't volunteering right now? They might see this and think, hey, you know what? Maybe I should get more active.
Yes, we would love that to happen. So that's why, you know, during the YICU event, we will encourage them to bring their friends and family and their friends and their peers to see what's going on. And hopefully that will inspire them.
Well, there's a lot of really great young people in this town. Is it tough to narrow it down and make a choice?
Absolutely. The great thing is that our steering committee here that goes through the applications, we definitely go through them and make sure everyone is qualified. But then we actually send the applications up to Chicago for a nonpartisan party to look through and go through the applications and make sure they actually choose the 10 finalists.
So you have an award celebration coming up on September the 10th.
Yes, we do. September 10th, 2017. It's going to be from 1 to 3 at the Park Regency Hotel. We encourage the public to come. We just think it's a great thing to recognize our youth who are giving back and being servant leaders.
If you were to recommend a young person get active, what's a good way to get started in giving back in their community?
Probably looking at the nonprofits that we have here in town. There are so many, and there's constantly fundraisers going on. They are constantly needing volunteers, and that would be the best way to start, was just looking at our local community for the nonprofits that they could serve.
That's Cheryl Hussein, a member of the board of directors for the philanthropic organization For a Better Tomorrow. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Nominations for the YICU Youth Service Award are due by January 15th. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from SEFCU, offering competitive rates for home equity lines of credit. Borrowers get personalized service without the hidden fees or early payoff penalties. Plus, SEFCU even covers closing costs for qualified members. Information at SEFCU.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Unlike chaplains who work at hospitals, cancer center chaplains usually visit with patients on a long-term basis. Cheryl Peterson Carlin, is the chaplain at the Community Cancer Center in Normal. She often meets with patients just after they receive their diagnosis and is there to help guide them through their treatment. She may eventually officiate at a patient's funeral. Peterson Carlin, who is an ordained Church of the Brethren minister, sat down recently with GLT's Judy Valente in the Cancer Center's chapel overlooking a well-kept garden to talk about how her work is about listening, meeting people where they are, and helping them find possible giving hope.
One of the significant differences and a part certainly that endears me to my work is that we see patients over a period of time. So for example, over the 5 years that I've been here, there are patients I've been following and relating to the whole time that I've been here. Another piece of that is that I'm a part of the whole continuum of care many times from time of diagnosis, and certainly celebrating with people when they're cancer-free, but also there at times of reoccurrence or times of end of life, sometimes participating in memorial services or funerals, and then also doing some grief follow-up with families. So there's this opportunity to develop and to nurture relationships over time. And I think that's part of what builds up this place of trust and opportunity to kind of be a spiritual guide and healing presence for people.
What are some of the things that people want to talk to you about?
Initially, they want to share their story, what happened or what they know about their illness and how they're coping and adjusting. For many people, particularly those that are struggling more with spiritual distress, dealing with strong emotions, with fear, with anger, with anxiety, with depression, sometimes with a sense of being alone in this illness. Patients will tell us, I can be in a room full of people and surrounded by people and still feel very alone in this illness. For some, it's this search for meaning, for purpose, for asking, you know, big questions. Why is this happening to me? You know, why is God allowing this to happen? Or you know, why is there this kind of suffering in the world? And the reality, cancer isn't the only thing we're dealing with in life, right? Most people that I meet, there are other issues related to relationships and family and other things that they're struggling with. So it's really kind of entering into what their experience is at that time.
Well, you mentioned a question that they have is, why is this happening and why is this happening to me? Do you have any good answers to give them?
Well, of course, as a good chaplain would say, you know, the answer comes from the person that you're listening to. And I firmly believe that. As a chaplain, my job is certainly to be grounded in my own religious tradition and to live, to serve from that place. But my job is really to honor the person that I'm working with and to listen to their experience, how they make meaning and purpose, what is the sacred to them, what is holy, and then to encourage them to dig and to explore those answers themselves. Ultimately, you know, I think there's not a lot of great answers to the why in this life. I think there's some things that we're going to understand greater when we know more fully. But I do think, you know, the question is not always just why, but what now? What am I going to do now that I'm in this situation? How am I going to respond and live? I also think the wrestling with that question sometimes is just a wrestling. People want to be heard. They want to describe some of the angst that they're feeling when life sometimes feels like it just doesn't make sense.
What are the toughest cases that you come across as a cancer chaplain?
Well, there are several that are difficult. Certainly some of our younger patients, patients with young families, can be difficult and challenging situations. Some of our patients that don't have a very good support system, that are very limited in the resources and coping abilities that they have in dealing with illness and with treatment. And then I think the most difficult are those that are having a hard time finding any hope. I think that comes sometimes for our patients that have undergone treatment for a long time and perhaps don't see an end to that. You know, they have an advanced progression of the disease and are pretty much going to be on treatment of some sort for the remainder of their days. And of course, people can cope and deal with that well, but if you don't have hope, that can be a very difficult and desperate place to be.
How do you feel you give people hope, or can you give people hope?
Again, I think, you know, you listen to a person's story and try to connect with the resources that they have, but ultimately you ask questions about hope. What gives you hope? Where is your hope now? And of course, everyone hopes for a cure. That's my hope for all of our patients as well. But I, you know, I talk about hope moving. You know, hope may move to having more time. Hope may move to quality of life. Hope may move to a peaceful death. And ultimately, you know, I encourage people to recognize that hope is something bigger, that there is an ultimate hope, and there's, you know, to explore what that source of meaning and purpose and divine might be for them.
What has been maybe your most memorable case that you've worked on?
All the remarkable, wonderful people that I meet. It's really a privilege to do this kind of work and to enter into people's lives at such a vulnerable time. But I'm going to share about a young man that I met several years ago. When he came to us, he was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. He very quickly found his life facing many losses, you know, being unable to work, being much weaker, and then unable to drive his motorcycle, which was one of the loves of his life, and, you know, weaker to the point where he was unable to do a lot of his own care. And even as his life got smaller, he was seeking ways to make life bigger. We did a project here called The Wall of Hope, where people painted images of what gives them hope. And he, along with a local artist, created this beautiful image of a road less traveled, a road that splits. And he says, you can face adversity and illness, and you can go down a dark path, or you can choose to still find some beauty in the simple things of life, sitting on your porch and watching the squirrels go by, talking to a friend, listening to music. And so as his world got smaller, he was really seeking ways to live it to the fullest. It was kind of like my own Tuesdays with Maury experience with a patient here.
How do you keep up your spirits? Because as you mentioned, sometimes you're called to speak at the funeral of someone that you've seen through the journey of their cancer treatment.
Following my own spiritual practices is critical, really, to my own health and my own prayer life, particularly contemplative prayer, centering prayer that quiets me, both in my life at home, but also taking brief moments for that in my work. And I think the other piece that helps me on a daily basis in my ministry here is to take that pause before I ever enter into a conversation with someone, to set my intention to be fully present to that person, and all in that moment, and to their experience, to what it is that they need to say, and where it is that they find their meaning, their purpose, their sense of connection.
There may be someone listening right now who's just gotten a cancer diagnosis, or someone they love, they're close to, has just gotten a cancer diagnosis. What can you say to them?
I would say to them that finding your own sense of spirituality can be an important part of your healing. It's so easy to put all of our focus on the medical piece, on surgery, on radiation, on chemotherapy, on appointments, and to lose something that can ground you. There's so much of the process of illness that we cannot control. The one thing that we do have some ability to control is how we respond to it. And that's an inside job. And, you know, all people are spiritual beings. Some of us have a religious expression of that, but all of us have a way that we make meaning out of life and find a sense of purpose for our living. So finding some simple practices and engaging with those, whether that's prayer or meditation or quiet or reading, doing spiritual readings, taking a walk in nature, doing some kind of creative project, having heart-to-heart conversations with those you love, finding some ways to ground yourself in the midst of that experience, I think is important.
We've been talking with Cheryl Peterson-Carlin, who is the chaplain at the Community Cancer Center. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
You don't expect to hear the word gift used in the same sentence as cancer, but that's how Marcia O'Donnell describes her life since her diagnosis of advanced breast cancer a few years ago. O'Donnell, who was a mental health professional before staying home to care for her two young children, credits her positive attitude in part to being able to share her questions, fears, and sometimes overwhelming emotions with Peterson Carlin, the Cancer Center chaplain. O'Donnell tells GLT's Judy Valente she initially did not want to meet the chaplain.
I really didn't want to speak with Cheryl. I mean, I thought, hey, there's this nice lady, but, you know, back off. I'm really not ready to talk about this.
So how did the rapport get established then between the two of you?
Frankly, I think it was Cheryl's persistence. It really wasn't something that I sought out actively, but Cheryl did. And I think she is very in tune with the patients here. And certainly has an expertise in kind of feeling out someone's personalities and understanding that, you know, some people may take some more time, but that her calling is to be a lamp and shine a light for people and give them hope. And I think she could really sense with me that I wanted that, but I wasn't ready to really open up.
So what did you end up talking about? What types of things, just in general?
Well, I kind of turned the tables on her, and she was nice enough to open up about her own family, her own experience, her children, her husband. And once that occurred, I felt more ready to kind of open up myself about how I was feeling and what was going on with me. She's a human being, and we could relate to each other as human beings.
So what would you say was the help or solace, as you put it, comfort that you received from the chaplain?
Now, Cheryl is a chaplain, but she does not, she's not an evangelical. She's not going around trying to save anyone. But certainly, I think the power and the gift of what she represents is something that can overcome any barrier. And eventually, I think I became more active in my church. I became I relied more on my religious beliefs and experiences. And as that happened, Cheryl and I were able to come together and really make an experience that is very scary and fearful into one that is more peaceful and tolerable and comforting. Ultimately,
how would you say that she gave you hope?
By speaking to me as a person, she's certainly not patronizing, or, you know, she doesn't condescend to, and she doesn't pretend to understand exactly what you're going through, but offers an outlet for you to speak about anything. And she can really tolerate the tears. She can be present for the pain. She can really be available through it all without judgment and without being reactive.
And I guess this is something that you really cannot do with your doctor. I mean, perhaps there's just not time.
Absolutely. I think Well, actually, I have to say I can do that with my oncologist because he's great, but for the most part, you're absolutely right. There isn't that comfort level. It's not what they're there to do, and that they don't have the time set aside really to do it.
People often say that cancer is a transformative experience in their life. What was your experience like?
It was a layer of losses, a systematic experience of being stripped of an outward and superficial identity. I had already decided to be a stay-at-home mom, so I didn't have that professional identity to really kind of buoy me up. Losing my health, losing my stamina. So becoming sort of isolated in that regard. And so here I am then, I'm a human being, alive, but what is my identity? How do I find meaning in my life now without being the person that I was before? And I think that was the ultimate gift, because the truth is that all of us are worthy and lovable as we are, without the buildup, without the markers, without the identifiers that we fall back on every day to make ourselves feel worthwhile. And so for me to be free of those things and to be able to feel love for myself without those identifiers allows me to feel love for everyone else too.
And how would you say you're doing now?
Before treatment and before my, I guess, religious enlightenment and relationship with Cheryl and moving forward, I wasn't doing very well. And I think now I am doing better than I ever have. I have much more peace and love and comfort in my life, and I feel really stable, even though my circumstances really haven't changed that much. My cancer is in remission. I have 3 more years before I'd be pronounced cancer-free, but I just got a PET scan done today to see, you know, if it's returned or not, because I'm starting to have symptoms again. But it could be anything, as I said, you know, you never know. But, you know, it's a difficult journey. Once your treatment has stopped, your experience with cancer doesn't stop. And that's something that you deal with really forever.
Well, we'll certainly be rooting for you and wishing for the best.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marcia.
Cancer Center patient Marcia O'Donnell talking with GLT's Judy Valente. O'Donnell received a good report from her doctors the day she spoke with GLT, and her cancer remains in remission. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the stories and interviews you heard today thanks to Judy Valente, Charlie Schlenker, and Laura Kennedy at WGLT.org. That's also where you can find the full show podcast. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.